The food war has begun. Heads of state, financial investors, and bureaucrats meet together. FTAA, G8, NAFTA, WTO, or IMF. The names, the locations change. The struggle remains the same. The richest countries have set the table for an unimaginable war. Yet, like generals, representatives of the empire of wealthy countries give orders and ultimatums. Food is just another type of business. Borders must be abolished. Around the world, people are denouncing the perversity of a system which replaces democracy with economy.
We tend to look in cities at our stores that are filled with food and our department stores that are filled with clothing and electronics and cars and all of this stuff. And our political leaders and business people say, it's this strong economy that gives you all of that. If we don't have a healthy economy, you can't have all this stuff. Well, the reality is all of that, whether it's rubber or glass or plastic or energy, all of that comes from the earth. It's the earth that delivers everything that we need to make what we want. It's not, and it's the earth that gives, makes the economy possible. It's only someone who is completely twisted who thinks that it's the economy that makes that possible.
Civil society is reacting. The man in the street and those who make a living from the land are worried. Farmers around the world are speaking up. The opposition is increasingly taking the form of a resistance movement.
The struggle must become an everyday struggle. And in it, we must not be afraid to break the law.
Today, the world markets are killing millions of people throughout the world. Some 800 million people do not live adequately. They do not have enough food. They're starving because of the market economy, not because we don't produce enough.
Every day, the television feeds us images of events from all over the world. We hear words like dumping, guerrilla, and overproduction, bioterrorism, embargo, starvation, deportation. On the surface, they're not related, but we must go beyond that. From the four corners of the world, here are seven fronts of the food war.
We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization, and for the religious faiths they practice. We have no ambition in Iraq except to remove a threat and restore control of that country to its own people.
Nowhere else is the food war as devastating as the conventional war. The Gulf War killed 100,000 people. The embargoes have killed 500,000 innocent children.
Nutrition of the mother is very important during pregnancy. Most of the mothers are either young or they're not receiving nutrition because of the situation in the country. So their children usually are born with low birth weight. And they have problems with their nutrition. So yani, most of the time, they don't. Yani, it's not compatible with life, they die. Nutrition means that they have low immunity. Malnutrition means that they have low immunity. They can't fight any illnesses, any diseases. So they are left to die.
The food war, it's a shameful war, a silent war. Nobody's interested in it.
Statue of Liberty in front of one that greets people who come to America, but in real life, the real story, that the end result are people are suffering and are dying because of crimes they did not commit.
International organizations recognize how serious the situation is. but there's no mention of it in the West. According to UNICEF, 5,000 children die in Iraq every month.
Well, UNICEF doesn't get into the issue of the embargo. This is a UN Security Council issue. Basically, what we can show here clearly that there, we are going through a humanitarian crisis in this country. And, I mean, the people are suffering very much, and that is clear. And the children particularly are the victims, the major victims of the situation.
We're touring the markets and supply centers. The people are poor. Ration coupons don't provide the basics for survival. Thanks to the oil for food agenda, each Iraqi receives the equivalent of $6.50 every month to live on. This makes Iraqis among the poorest people on the planet. Iraqis don't have the means to produce the food they need. We stop at the Baghdad Aqueduct. It's in pathetic shape. Iraqis who drink this water are poisoned. The embargo does not allow them to replace defective equipment. The chemicals required to purify the water are forbidden for military consideration. The bombings deliberately destroy the aqueduct and purification systems. In 1991, the United Nations Security Council, at the urging of the American government, placed an embargo on Iraq. In 1996, this embargo became known as oil for food. The name speaks volumes about the real stakes of this war.
And we target the civilians in Iraq in two ways. We target them through malnutrition, through the oil for food program, and we target them through weapons. Repeated bombing attacks of 98 and again recently this year. This is a crime against humanity. This is, in my view, a deliberate policy to destroy this people, this culture.
We're on the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. It was here, 8,000 years ago, that agriculture and civilization were born. A strange return of history. Now in Iraq, the land of Abraham, people die of hunger. Here, food as weapon flexes its muscle. Give us your oil, and we'll give you, maybe, something to eat. Agriculture of rich countries is invading the planet by the sheer force of billions of dollars and share with the military similar goals and similar technology.
When the United States went to war with Iraq, the global positioning system would take the smart bombs and put them down a chimney. I mean, they were that precise, and they're using it today in Afghanistan. That's a global positioning system, and what that system tells you is your location, no matter where you are in the world, tells you exactly where you are. So today, when the crop dusters fly these fields with fertilizer, they're all controlled and guided by the satellites. GPS, Global Positioning System.
Satellites, GPS, in-flight computers, sophisticated machinery, American farmers rely on state-of-the-art technology that is very expensive. On his farm not far from Houston, J.D. Woods, a major rice producer, invested millions of dollars in all sorts of equipment.
The investment for rice farming is huge. It's a labor-intensive crop. It's one that takes lots of input, fertilizer, herbicides, fungicides, insecticides. All of those things are very expensive. When I started, we're accustomed to producing 5,000 pounds to the acre. Today, 10,000 pounds to the acre has been achieved.
In Katy, Texas, the annual Rice Harvest Festival has become a piece of folklore. The farmers have disappeared, one after the other. Those who remain are part of an industry.
The business world is consolidating. It's growing larger. I mean, the banks are doing it, on and on and on. The businesses are doing it. The oil companies are doing it. The farmers have to do it, too.
Decisions concerning agriculture are too important to be left to farmers. Like here in Houston, the headquarters of financial and industrial institutions have taken over agriculture. It's now integrated with other strategic sectors like aerospace research, high technology, and the petrochemical and heavy equipment industries. Even though they supply 90% of their domestic market, the richest in the world, American rice producers do not cover their expenses. Despite the investments, despite the technology, American agriculture is not profitable. In the same way it finances the army, the American government finances agriculture with billions of dollars for strategic reasons.
Most American consumers do not understand, most American housewives do not understand that government subsidy to the farmer buys down the price of the rice that they buy. There's no way we can grow rice today for $4. The production cost in America is about $11 per 100 pounds.
In 2002, the American government announced an increase of $180 billion to support farmers. These subsidies are a powerful weapon. They support the farmers in their domestic market and destabilize the international market.
Well, our government today has programs whereby they give subsidies to farmers. And what this does is it buys down the price of the rice all over the world.
Subsidies and embargoes are traditional tactics of the food war. Here in the suburbs of Houston, scientists are creating biotechnological weapons for reasons that are seemingly commercial.
There are some companies in Texas, Rice Tech comes to mind in Alvin, Texas, that has developed varieties to really compete with Thai jasmine rice and Indian basmati.
Owned by the wealthy Prince of Liechtenstein, Rice Tech is in the vanguard of the research in rice genetic engineering. Rice Tech works closely with the biggest biotechnology companies and benefits from the patent policy of the American government.
In the case of Indian basmati rice, for instance, that's some of the most expensive rice in the world. And if we could produce a rice here in the United States, a very similar taste and qualities such as that, we think we could grab a large share of that market because we could produce it more cheaply.
Scientists have been preparing for years one of the most important battles of the food war. A battle that could affect forever the lives of billions of people. The countries of the Third World are the primary target for genetic modified organism, GMOs, and agricultural inputs. In India, the small farmers can't avoid the onslaught. In the West, farmers use only a few varieties of seeds developed by large corporations. Here, Indian farmers can count on 30,000 varieties of rice. There exists a variety adapted to every growing situation. For the 500,000 farmers, like Mrs. Kamlesh Devi, the seeds of rice are of the utmost importance. They represent both the future and the continuity. 80% of the farmers keep aside the best seeds from their harvest. Each farmer relies only on himself.
For India, which has deliberately maintained itself as an agricultural society, a rural society with very decentralized systems of production, ensuring that people could make their livelihood freely, working the land, producing crafts. For that, three quarters of India, which is 750 million people.
In 1987, in northern India, not far from Dehradun, Dr. Shiva created the Navdanya Center, whose mandate it is to preserve agricultural diversity and the skills of small Indian farmers. Navdanya, which means nine grains, is a national network of community banks. With the help of renowned scientists, the center promotes an agriculture based on the traditional knowledge of Indian farmers. The center preserved 2,000 strains of rice, and among them, 17 of basmati rice specific to that region. In northern India, at the foothills of the Himalayas, stretches the land of basmati, from Pakistan through the Punjab to here in the Doon Valley. This is the main region for basmati in all of India.
The basmati that grows in this beautiful valley, the Dehradun basmati, amazing aromatic rice that elongates when it cooks. A mile away from a basmati farm during the cultivation and harvesting season, you can smell genuine basmati.
The most famous market for basmati is here in Dehradun. Much sought after throughout the world, the exportation of basmati rice is essential to the Indian economy. It took thousands of years to develop this rice. Every grain of basmati contains the knowledge of generations of farmers. In 1997, the Texas company Rice Tech applied for 20 patents on rice varieties created in the United States but derived from native Indian seed stock. In the past, conquistadors plundered the gold of conquered countries. Nowadays, we steal their genes.
We have shared and saved seed for centuries. We run a program and a movement. We built a movement in this country called Navdanya to freely exchange seed. Seed traveling from farmer to farmer, country to country, is not stolen seed. But when a rice tech in Texas claims they invented these are their trademarks, these are the products of their mind, when they came from our farms, that is piracy. Their monopoly is a piracy. If they had merely shared and asked, Indian peasants are generous enough to say, sure, go ahead and grow basmati in Texas, you'll just have less aroma and you'll have bad quality, but we don't mind you're getting the seeds. It's the patent, the monopoly, and the claim to invention that is an outrage. This is a product of piracy.
Acting like bioterrorists, companies like Rice Tech travel the world and pirate genetic material from cereals that belong to the world's patrimony. Then in their labs, they genetically modify these food-producing plants and take out patents on them. The rules of the World Trade Organization protect these companies.
What I see happening is we get the promise of high-tech agriculture, which is dominated by large multinational corporations who right now are on a war front trying to corral or to own basically the genomes of our domesticated crops. So a company like Monsanto would like to own all of the crops, the genomes of the plants that they then can sell to farmers in India and Africa and North America. And I think that's a major danger.
They would like to collect royalties from impoverished farmers, costly pesticides, Roundup, the biggest program, and World Bank money is being used to market Roundup in Indian rural areas.
Supported by international development organizations, the large international biotech companies create these new seeds by citing the necessity of feeding the starving masses.
The idea that, well, population's going to grow, we got to keep getting all this biotech in order to keep feeding more and more people, it's crazy. It's not going to feed them now. It's not going to feed them 40 years from now. So I think that the whole idea that's being sold by the multinational corporations, that they're going to increase productivity to feed the starving people of the world, is nonsense, because it costs money to develop these biotech foods. Our Monsanto and all of these companies, when they develop them, which I don't believe they will, but if they did, are they going to give them to the people in Africa and India and Southeast Asia where they need them? Or is the investor going to say, oh, no, 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 I don't care about making money. Let's give it to the people that need it the most. The people that need it don't have money.
60% of the world's population is fed by small farmers outside the international agro-food system. Yet we impose by force a system that ransacks all the rural economies.
Today we see this as a problem of destruction of farmers' livelihood and the creation of starvation and hunger. Tomorrow it will be of absolute social breakdown.
In 1997, a terrible disaster struck Taiwan. An epidemic of foot and mouth disease hit the country's large swine population. The army was called in. 4 million pigs had to be slaughtered and their carcasses disposed of. Taiwan's farmers had been too greedy and were now crashing headlong into the pitfall of overproduction. Buddhists prayed to appease the spirits of the sacrificed animals. The gods were no longer favorable. Thousands of small farmers have vanished. In 1997, 50,000 Taiwanese farmers raising pigs, even the largest, like Mr. Fang, were hit by the disaster. Taiwan lost its main client, Japan. Losses added up to billions of dollars. Many farmers went bankrupt. Others, among them Mr. Fang, had to drastically decrease their production.
We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization, and for the religious faiths they practice. We have no ambition in Iraq except to remove a threat and restore control of that country to its own people.
Nutrition of the mother is very important during pregnancy. Most of the mothers are either young or they're not receiving nutrition because of the situation in the country. So their children usually are born with low birth weights. And they have problems with their nutrition. So most of the time, they don't. It's not compatible with life. They die. Nutrition means that they have low immunity. Malnutrition means that they have low immunity. They can't fight any illnesses, any diseases. So they are left to die.
In 1987, in northern India, not far from Dehradun, Dr. Shiva created the Navdanya Center, whose mandate it is to preserve agricultural diversity and the skills of small Indian farmers. Navdanya, which means nine grains, is a national network of community banks. In 1997, a terrible disaster struck Taiwan. An epidemic of foot and mouth disease hit the country's large swine population. The army was called in. 4 million pigs had to be slaughtered and their carcasses disposed of. At the National University of Taiwan in Taipei, the epidemic mobilized the Department of Veterinary Medicine. Its director, Professor Lai, witnessed the transformation Taiwanese swine production had undergone.
Status of the pork production in Taiwan has been revolutionary changes. From the backyard raising pigs to the industrialized or commercialized business.
At the northern tip of the island, in the harbor of Keelung, warships rub shoulders with merchant ships. From the heights of the city, the statue of Kuan Yin overlooks the harbor of Keelung. She is the goddess of sailors and also of farmers. Every day, she sees thousands of tons of goods coming and going. Taiwan depends on its main commercial and military ally, the United States. To redress the balance of trade, the Americans have imposed the sale of their own products, especially cereals. In Taiwan, 97% of the grain fed to pigs comes from the United States. Mr. Fang is not only a farmer, he's also the shareholder of a large feed mill. He imports soya from the United States, extracts the oil which he sells for human consumption, and then feeds the residues to his animals. That's what's called integration. Industrial swine production is a major polluter. Taiwan is a small island, 500 kilometers long, 150 kilometers wide. The feces of 12 million pigs have been added to those of some 20 million Taiwanese. Taiwan has been devastated. The United States made the profits, the Japanese ate the meat, the Taiwanese are still paying the consequences. Mr. Fang has invested in a waste treatment system, but the environment and the water supplies of the island have been severely damaged.
Well, the environmental impact will be paid by the society. So I think this is not fair for the total society.
The food war gives no respite. Taiwan has to return to the line of fire. Before reconquering the Japanese market, it will be necessary to reassure a population deeply shocked and disgusted by the production methods of the swine industry. Encouraged by the farmers, the president of Taiwan sets the example. Here in Taiwan, 4 million pigs have been sacrificed. Thousands of farmers have been ruined. As on land, the food war is raging. Fishermen are caught in a no-mercy war. The battle can't be avoided. Too many boats, less and less fish. Armed by major food companies, the industrial fishermen search the high seas looking for fishing zones that are ill-defended. Heading south towards Africa, the fight continues. We are in St. Louis, in Senegal. Here, every day, fishermen risk their lives. Danger comes from everywhere, from the elements, the surf they have to cross, the ships cruising nearby, and from the precarious work conditions. These large ships off St. Louis sail under the Korean flag. Tomorrow, they will come from France, Spain, or Japan. Aruna Dian protested the signing of the fishing treaty between Senegal and the European Community.
Senegal used to have lots of fish, but that is no longer the case. There are no more fish because of the large ships that come along our coast and take back their catch to Europe.
Senegalese can't afford to buy the fish caught in their own waters. It's the consumers of the rich nations who will savor it.
The only source of animal protein that we have in our region, and in almost three-quarters of the country, comes from these little sardines. Everybody eats them. Without these little sardines, we would starve.
When there are no sardines for 2 or 3 days, the whole population of Saint Louis is penalized. There are no big fish that we can afford to buy, only sardines. And with the new fishing treaty, it will even be worse when they start fishing our little sardines too.
One after the other, coastal communities and fishermen disappear, vanquished. The high seas fishing wars are won every day by the industrial fleets. Their only real plan is profit. Fast profit, profit at any price.
I don't cry for myself. I cry for my children and grandchildren. Because tomorrow, they won't have enough resources to feed themselves. Tomorrow, there will be nothing left. And if there is nothing left, what are we fishermen going to do? We are not civil servants. We don't work in an office and get a paycheck. We are not farmers. We have no land to cultivate. We have only the ocean. And if the ocean has no more resources, what are we going to do? We will go to the cemetery and we will wait for you.
Throughout the food war, rich nations colonize whole countries in order to obtain food supplies at low cost. 2,000 years ago, the Maya, builders of temples, grew corn to feed themselves. This vital link with the land has remained intact. Like their ancestors, the Indians of the Chiapas in Mexico are known as the corn people. They live a modest and difficult life. Proud, they have been able to resist the onslaughts of history. Today, they may lose everything as their land is coveted by a new generation of conquerors. The Indians find themselves at the heart of the turmoil. They're engaged in an unequal combat with those who want their land. Here, the food war is fought by people who have taken up arms. Tens of thousands of Mexican troops patrol the Chiapas region, imposing the law of a new economic order. In 1994, Mexico, the United States, and Canada signed NAFTA, a treaty regulating free trade in North America. Thus began the era of free trade in North America. NAFTA and free trade have intensified the food war. Indians feared their standard of living would deteriorate. Time proved them right. 8 years after the signature of the agreement, 80% of the Mexican population is poorer. The price of a tortilla, a daily staple, and often the only food for 40 million Mexicans, has doubled. The small farmers are headed for ruin.
I remember when I was 8 years old, we had meat once a week. There was enough quantity. But today, this is no longer the case.
The Indians claim their right to feed themselves, as they have done for thousands of years. The food war takes place on two fronts, the fight for the land and the fight for food. Thanks to NAFTA and to their industrial superiority, big American food companies have taken over the corn market, which allows them to get rid of their surplus grain production. Mexico, which used to be self-sufficient, must now import corn to feed its population. According to this logic, the Mexicans should select crops that have a commercial value on the North American market. Hey. Jorge San Diego is the coordinator of DESME, an agency which supports and helps the development of Indian communities in the Chiapas. Mr. San Diego, who has already been imprisoned for his humanitarian actions, is preoccupied by the inevitable impact of the changes.
The fundamental thing for the small farmers is the modification of Article 27 of the Mexican Constitution, a modification that is very crucial for the multinational companies. The deeds would allow agribusiness to take over, thus transforming the methods of local production.
Around the world, agribusiness is gobbling up the small farmers' lands. In this context, the traditional farmers must be eliminated.
They often repeat that hope is not dead. They say, they can kill us. They have already killed a lot of us. But hope is still alive.
From the banks of the Amazon to the beaches of Rio, Brazil is synonymous with paradise, escape, and wealth. A large territory with amazing natural resources and a young population of 170 million people, Brazil is the country of the future. Yet the food war is more intense here than anywhere else. These buildings, surrounded by barbed wire and watchtowers, belong to powerful landlords who own huge facilities where soya is treated and dried. In order to supply these factories, the land has been transformed into a huge green sea, a monoculture of soya. The food-producing plants for local sustenance have been eliminated. So were the farmers. In the south, like in the north, the fazendeiros receive, often free of charge from the government, pieces of land as large as countries. Thus, in just a few years, the immense Amazonian forest has been transformed into a vast pasture for cattle. Meanwhile, millions of small farmers, deprived of land, are desperately looking for a place to settle down. Many have fled the faziendas where they were employed. Those farmers only want a piece of land to feed themselves. In 1996, in El Dorado dos Carayas, the military police and the big fazendeiros decided to set an example. That day, the police fired on an unarmed crowd. 19 landless farmers were killed, 70 others were badly wounded. A modest building reminds us of the slaughter. After a trial of 6 years, and despite a few convictions, the people responsible for the killings are still free. Henri Burin Desrosiers is a lawyer. With the Pastoral Commission of the Earth, he tries to alert worldwide public opinion and to have those guilty of the crimes convicted. He doesn't hesitate to speak of a regime of slavery.
Why is this type of work slavery? Because the workers are no longer free, not even free to get out or to leave the fazenda. They're not paid. They're isolated in the forest. They don't know anything. And sometimes, the ones that try to escape, unfortunately, we have seen many cases, sometimes the pistoleros kill them or capture them and bring them back in chains to the fazenda they fled. We have seen this happening lately. So this is a regime of slavery.
Thousands of farm workers who escaped the clutches of the fazendeiros have nowhere to go. Their only choice is to settle on abandoned land. Jose Batista is also a lawyer for the PCE. He tries to come to their aid despite the threat of violence.
Se a gente for olhar bem o número de trabalhadores que foram assassinados aqui nessa região nos últimos anos,
the number of people who have been murdered in this region maybe outnumbers the people killed in many civil wars throughout the world. Here, in this region, it is war, a guerrilla civil war.
People fight to keep their land,
the poor have no food, no work, and no support from their government. On the other side, landowners are extremely rich, very well armed, very violent, and they hire thugs to kill the people who occupy these lands.
Contratam pistoleiros para poder matar os trabalhadores que ocupam as terras dos latifúndios improdutivos.
We are in what's left of the Amazonian jungle in the state of Pará, in the region of Rondon. A few months ago, small farmers took over some land. They established a camp, an acampamento. Their future seemed brighter. Their joy was short-lived.
We arrived here thanks to a friend called Dezinho. We were 66 families without work. And since he was a member of the union and had always worked with the union, we asked him to find us some work.
He
contacted us, we met, and we came here following the information that this plot was unproductive and that there existed no document saying that this land had an owner.
Even if that piece of land was in the heart of the jungle, the big landowners decided to teach the farmers a lesson. They would eliminate the man who had encouraged them to take over the abandoned land. They would take out Dezinho.
Dezinho
foi brutalmente assassinado.
Was brutally murdered for unfair reasons.
Por motivo que talvez não seja nem justo por motivo dessa terra que
he died because of this land.
Dele se contar em alguém.
Dezinho.
Dezinho's murder has not been punished. The pistolero who committed the crime is in jail, but the landlord who ordered it is free. This pattern of violence is present everywhere in Brazil. In the large agricultural region of Paraná in the south of Brazil, taking over the land is the only way for starving small farmers. Adelir de Lima is barely 20. He's a member of the Landless Farmers Movement. He tells the struggle of his companions.
They scared us into giving up and leaving. Every evening, there were shootings. They attacked people in the camp. Many of my friends were shot and wounded.
It's very difficult because we come from huge farms owned by major landlords, and we are working hard here. But we don't know what to do. We don't know what we will do if they expel us. Are we going to go back where we came from? Are we going to work for the big landlords? Or are we going to be forced to live along the roads and the highways?
Ou será que nós vamos para a beira do asfalto?
Brazil is a microcosm of what's happening in the rest of the world with a system based solely on the logic of economy. Opulence for the rest. While the mega food corporations calculate their profits, people are dying. And people are dying to keep the right to feed themselves.
Come on. Come on.
Every grain of soil is precious because it's this soil that nourishes life.
Mostra a terra, mostra a terra, terra, mostra a terra na câmera.
The hope for a better world will become reality if the earth is shared through new bonds of respect and solidarity.